my sister's willingness to lie with him. And then I was newly jealous for all the years that I had missed of the wild sweetness between lovers. Rachel and Jacob spent many nights together, exploring the new heat between them, and Rachel hoped again. Some midwives said that pleasure overheated the seed and killed it, but others claimed that babies only come when women smile. This was the tale she told Jacob to inspire his caresses. During the last months of Bilhah's pregnancy, Zilpah went to Jacob's bed for the first time. She did not offer herself as Bilhah had, although she was at least 5 years older, as old as Leah, who had borne 5 live sons by that time. Zilpah knew it would happen someday, and she was resigned to it. But unlike Bilhah, Zilpah would never ask. Leah would have to command it. Finally, she did. One night, when I was walking in the light of a full moon, she appeared before me, Zilpah said. At first I thought I was dreaming. My sister slept as heavily as Laban and never rose at night. Even her own babies had trouble rousing her. But there she was, in the stillness. We walked in the bright white light of the Lady Moon, hand in hand, for a long time. And again, I wondered if this was really my sister or a ghost, because the woman beside me was silent, whereas Leah always had something to say. Finally, she spoke with careful words about the moon. She told me how much she loved the white light, and how she spoke to the moon and called to her by name every month. Leah said the moon was the only face of the goddess that seemed open to her, because of the way the moon called forth the filling and emptying of her body. My sister was wise, said Zilpah. She stopped and faced me and took both my hands in hers and asked, Are you ready to swallow the moon at last? What could I say? It was my time. Indeed, it was possible that she had waited too long, and Zilpah half hoped she was too old, at 25, to bear. Age alone was no good augury. Rachel had been barren from her youth, despite all her efforts, and Leah, fertile as a watered plain, showed no sign of giving off. The only way to discover what the mother of life had in store for Zilpah was for her to go into Jacob and become the least of his wives. The next morning, Leah spoke to Jacob. Bilhah offered to put henna on Zilpah's hands, but she set her mouth and refused. That night she walked slowly to Jacob's tent, where he lay with her and knew her. Zilpah took no pleasure from Jacob's touch. I did what was required of me, she said, with such a tone that no one dared ask her to say more. She never complained of Jacob's attentions. He did his best to calm her fears, just as he had with his other wives. He called for her many times, trying to win her. He asked her to sing songs of the goddesses and brushed her hair, but nothing he did moved Zilpah. I never understood my sister's eagerness to lie with Jacob, she said, with a weary wave of her long hand. It was a duty, like grinding grain, something that wears away at the body, but is necessary so that life can go on. Mind you, I was not disappointed, she said. It was nothing I expected to enjoy. Zilpah conceived during Bilhah's pregnancy, and soon after Bilhah's Dan was born, it truly did appear as though Zilpah had swallowed the moon. On her slender frame, the belly looked huge and perfectly round. Her sisters teased her, but Zilpah only smiled. She was glad to be free from Jacob's attentions, for men did not lie with pregnant women. She gloried in her new body and dreamed wonderful dreams of power and flight. She dreamed of giving birth to a daughter, not a human child, but a changeling of some kind, a spirit woman. Full-grown, full-breasted, she wore nothing but a girdle of string in front and in back. She strode the earth in great steps, and her moon blood made trees grow everywhere she walked. I loved to go to sleep when I was with child, said Zilpah. I traveled so far in my blankets those months. But when her time came, the baby was slow to appear, and Zilpah suffered. Her hips were too narrow, and labor lasted from sunset to sunset for 3 days. Zilpah cried and wailed, sure that her daughter would die, or that she would be dead before she saw her girl, her Ashrat, for she had chosen her name already and told it to her sisters in case she did not survive. It went hard with Zilpah. On the evening of the 3rd day of her labor, she was all but dead from the pains, which, strong as they were, did not seem to bring the baby any closer to this world. Finally, Inna resorted to an untried potion she had bought from a Canaanite trader. She reached her hand all the way up to the stubborn door of Zilpah's womb and rubbed a strong aromatic gum that did its work quickly, wrenching a shriek from Zilpah's throat, which by then was so hoarse from her travail that she sounded less like a woman than an animal caught in the fire. Inna whispered a fragment of an incantation in the name of the ancient goddess of healing. Gula, quicken the delivery. Gula, I appeal to you, miserable and distraught, tortured by pain, your servant. Be merciful and hear this prayer. Soon Zilpah was up on the bricks, with Leah standing behind her, supporting the birth of the child conceived in her name. Zilpah had no more tears by the time Inna directed her to push. She was ashen and cold. She was half dead, and there was no strength even to scream when the baby finally came, tearing her flesh front and back. It was not the hoped-for daughter, but a boy, long, thin, and black-haired. Leah hugged her sister and declared her lucky to have such a son, and lucky to be alive. Leah named him Gad for luck, and said, "May he bring you the moon and the stars and keep you safe in your old age." But the rejoicing in the red tent was cut short because Zilpah cried out again. The pain had returned. "I am dying! I am dying!" she sobbed, weeping for the son who would never know his mother. "He will live as I did," she wailed, "the orphan of a concubine, haunted by dreams of a cold, dead mother." "Unlucky one," she whimpered, "unlucky son of an unlucky mother." Inna and Rachel crouched on either side of the despairing mother, seeking the source of this new pain. Inna took Rachel's hand and placed it on Zilpah's belly, showing her a second child in the womb. "Don't give up yet, little mother," Inna said to Zilpah. "You will bear twins tonight. Didn't you dream of that?" "Not much of a priestess, is she?" she grinned. The second baby came quickly, since Gad had opened the way. He fell out of his mother's womb like ripe fruit. Another boy, also dark, but much smaller than the first. But his mother did not see him. A river of blood followed in his wake, and the light in Zilpah's eyes went out. Time and again, Inna and Rachel packed her womb with wool and herbs to staunch the bleeding. They wet her lips with water and strong honeyed brews. They sang healing hymns and burned incense to keep her spirit from flying out of the tent. But Zilpah lay on the blanket, not dead, but not alive either, for 8 days and more. She was not aware of the circumcision of Gad, or her second son, whom Leah named Asher, for the goddess Zilpah loved. Leah nursed the boys, and so did Bilhah and one of the bondswomen. After 10 days, Zilpah moaned and lifted her hands. "I dreamed 2 sons," she croaked. "Is it so?" They brought the babies to her, dark and thriving, and Zilpah laughed. Zilpah's laughter was a rare sound, but the names made her chuckle. Gad and Asher, Luck and the Goddess. It sounded like the name of a myth from the old days, she said. And I was Ninma, the exalted lady who birthed it all. Zilpah ate and drank and healed, though she could not nurse her sons. Her breasts had gone dry in her illness, but this was a sorrow she could bear. She had 2 sons, both fine and strong, and she did not regret her dream daughter. When they grew to boyhood and left her side, Zilpah sorrowed over the fact that she had no girl to teach. But when she held them in her arms, she tasted only the joy of mothers, the sweetest tears. Inna told her that she should take care not to bear for at least 2 years, but Zilpah had no intention of going through such pain again. She had given her family 2 sons. She sought out Jacob one morning before he left for the pasture and told him that another pregnancy would surely kill her. She asked that he remember this when he called a wife to his bed, and she never slept with Jacob again. Indeed, Jacob had trembled when he learned that he had gotten twins upon her. He was one of 2 himself, and it had caused him nothing but grief. "Forget that they shared their mother's womb," he ordered. It was so. Not because Jacob commanded it, but because the 2 were so different. Gad, long and lean, with his flutes and drum. Asher, the short, wiry husbandsman, with his father's talent with animals. Leah's next pregnancy also brought twin boys, Naphtali and Issachar. Unlike Zilpah's, though, these twins looked so much alike that as children, not even their mother could always tell them apart. Only Bilhah, who could see every leaf on a tree in its own light, was never fooled by those 2, who loved each other with a kind of quiet harmony that none of my other brothers knew. Poor Bilhah. After Dan, all her babies, a boy and 2 girls, died before weaning. But she never let her sorrow poison her heart, and she loved the rest of us instead. Jacob was now a man with 4 wives and 10 sons, and his name was known among the men of the countryside. He was a good father and took his boys with him into the hills as soon as they were able to carry their own water. And he taught them the ways of sheep and goats, the secrets of good pasturage, the habits of long walking, the skills of sling and spear. There, too, far from the tents of their mothers, he told them the terrible story of his father, Isaac. When Jacob and his sons stayed in the far pastures, keeping watch where a jackal had been seen, or simply to enjoy the cool night air of a summer month, he would tell his sons the story of how his grandfather, Abram, bound Isaac hand and foot and then raised a knife above the boy's throat to give El the sacrifice of his favorite son. El was the only god to whom Jacob bowed down, a jealous, mysterious god, too fearsome, he said, to be fashioned as an idol by human hands, too big to be contained by any place, even a place as big as the sky. El was the god of Abram, Isaac, and Jacob, and it was Jacob's wish that his sons accept this El as their god, too. Jacob was a weaver of words, and he would catch his eager audience in the threads of his tale, telling of the glinting knife, Isaac's eyes wide with fright. The rescue came at the last possible moment, when the knife was at Isaac's throat, and a drop of blood trickled down his neck, just like the tears falling from Abram's brimming eyes. But then a fiery spirit stayed the old man's hand and brought a pure white ram to be sacrificed in Isaac's stead. Reuben and Simon, Levi and Judah, would stare at their father's arm, stretched out against the starry night, and shudder to think of themselves on the altar. "The God of my fathers is a merciful God," Jacob said. But when Zilpah heard the story from her sons, she said, "What kind of mercy is that, to scare the spit dry in poor Isaac's mouth? Your father's God may be great, but he is cruel." Years later, when his grandsons finally met the boy of the story, by then an old man, they were appalled to hear how Isaac stuttered, still frightened by his father's knife. Jacob's sons adored their father, and his neighbors respected his success, but he was uneasy. Laban owned everything he had attained, the flocks, the bondsmen and their families, the fruit of the garden, the wool for trade. Nor was Jacob alone in his resentment of Laban. Leah and Rachel, Bilhah and Zilpah, chafed under the rule of their father, who seemed to grow more crude and arrogant as the years passed. He treated his own daughters like slaves and cuffed their sons. He profited from the labor of their looms without a word of thanks. He leered at the bondswomen and took their beer as a bribe against his lust. He mistreated Rudy every day. The 4 sisters spoke of these things in the red tent, which they always entered a day before the rest of the women in the camp. Perhaps their early years together, when they were the only women in camp, created a habit in their bodies that brought on the flow of blood some hours before the bondswomen. Or perhaps it was simply the need of their hearts to spend a day among themselves. In any event, the bondswomen did not complain, nor was it their place to say anything. Besides, Jacob's wives would always greet them with sweets as they entered to celebrate the new moon and rest on the straw. Ruti said nothing, but her blackened eyes and her bruises reproached them. No older than Leah, Ruti had grown haggard in their midst. After the birth of her sons, Laban had treated her well. The tight-fisted goat had even brought her bangles to brighten her wrists and ankles. But then she gave off bearing, and he began to hit her and call her names so ugly my mothers would not repeat them to me. Ruti's shoulders stooped with despair, and several of her teeth were broken from the force of Laban's fists. Even so, he continued to use her body for his own pleasure, a thought that made my mother shudder. For all their pity, Jacob's wives did not embrace Ruti. She was the mother of their sons' rivals, their material enemy. The bondswomen saw how the sisters kept themselves apart from her, and they followed suit. Even her own sons laughed at her and treated her like a dog. Ruti, already alone, kept to herself. She became such a ragged, battered misery to look at that no one saw her. When she came to Rachel, desperate for help, she seemed more a ghost than a woman. "Lady, I beg you, give me the herbs to cast out the baby I carry," she whispered in a cold, flat hiss. "I would rather die than give him another son. And if it is a girl, I will drown her before she is old enough to suffer at his hands." "Help me for the sake of your husband's sons," said Ruti, in a voice from the other side of the grave. "I know you will not do it for me. You hate me, all of you." Rachel brought Ruti's words to her sisters, who listened in silence and were ashamed. "Do you know how to do that?" asked Leah. Rachel waved a hand, dismissing the question as beneath consideration. It was not a difficult matter, especially since Ruti was in the first month. Bila's eyes blazed. "We are no better than he is to have let her suffer alone, to have given her no comfort, no help." Zilpah turned to Rachel and asked, "When will you do it?" "We must wait for the next new moon, when all the women come to us," Rachel answered. "Laban is too stupid to suspect anything. I don't think even the subtlest among them realizes what we know and do among ourselves. But it is better to be careful." The sisters did not change in their apparent treatment of Ruti. They did not speak to her or show her any special kindness. But at night, when Laban snored, one of the four would find her, huddled on her filthy blanket in a far corner of the tent, and feed her broth or honeyed bread. Zilpah took on Ruti's suffering as her own. She could not bear the emptiness in her eyes, or the despair that hung about her like a fog from the world of the dead. She took to visiting her every night to whisper words of encouragement into Ruti's ears, but she only lay there, deaf to any hope. Finally, the moon waned and all the women entered the red tent. Leah stood before the bondswomen and lied with a pure heart. "Ruti is unwell. Her courses are overdue, but her belly is hot, and we fear a miscarriage tonight. Rachel will do everything she can with herbs and incantations to save the child. Let us care for our sister, Ruti." But within a few minutes, it was clear to most of them that Rachel's ministrations were intended not to save the baby, but to cast it out. They watched from the far side of the red tent, where cakes and wine sat untouched, as Rachel mixed a black herbal brew, which Ruti drank in silence. She lay still, her eyes closed. Zilpah muttered the names of Anat, the healer, and the ancient Gula, who attends women at childbirth, while Rachel whispered words of praise to Ruti, whose courage unfolded as the night wore on. When the herbs began to work, causing great ripping cramps, Ruti made no sound. When the blood began to flow, clotted and dark, Rudy's lips did not part. As the hours passed, the blood ran and did not stop, and still she said nothing. Rachel packed Rudy's womb with wool many times, until finally it was over. No man knew what happened that night. No child blurted the secret, because none of the women ever spoke of it, not a word, until Zilpah told me the story. By then, it was nothing but an echo from the grave. My mother told me that after the birth of her twin sons, she decided to finish with childbearing. Her breasts were those of an old woman. Her belly was slack, and her back ached every morning. The thought of another pregnancy filled her with dread, and so she took to drinking fennel to keep Jacob's seed from taking root again. But then it happened that the supply of seeds ran low while Inna was far away in the north. Months passed, and still she did not return with her pouches of herbs. Leah tried an old remedy, soaking a lock of wool in old olive oil and placing it at the mouth of her womb before lying with Jacob. But her efforts failed, and for the first time, the knowledge of life within her brought her low. Leah did not wish to take this trouble to Rachel, whose hunger for her own baby had not diminished. The fertile wife had tried to spare her barren sister's feelings by keeping a respectful distance from her. They divided the duties of a chief wife. Leah had charge of the weaving and cooking, the garden and the children. Rachel, still lovely and slim-waisted, served her husband and waited upon traders who came to the camp. She looked after Jacob's needs, and her skills as a healer growing, saw to the pains and illnesses of men, women, and even beasts. Births and the new moon brought the two women together inside the red tent, but Leah slept facing the western wall, while Rachel hugged the east, and they spoke to each other only by way of their sisters, Leah through Zilpah, Rachel through Bilhah. Now, Leah had no choice. Inna had not returned, and Rachel was the only one who knew the herbs, the prayers, the proper massage. There was no one else to ask. As Rachel left to attend a birth in a nearby camp, Leah made some excuse about fetching water and rushed her steps until she was at Rachel's side. Leah's cheeks burned, and she cast her eyes downward as she asked her sister to help her as she had helped Rudy. Rachel surprised her with the gentleness of her answer. "Do not do away with your daughter," she said. "You are carrying a girl." "Then she will die," Leah answered, thinking of Rachel's miscarriages. Inna had pronounced them all girls. "And even if she lives, she will not know her mother because I am nearly dead from bearing." But Rachel argued for all of the sisters, who had long saved their treasures for a daughter. "We will do everything for you as you carry their girl." "Leah," she said, using her sister's name for the first time in either woman's memory, "please," she asked. "Do as I say before I tell Zilpah," Rachel threatened mischievously. "She will make your life a misery of scorned goddesses if she discovers your plans." Leah laughed and relented, for her wish for a daughter was still strong. "While I slept in my mother's womb, I appeared to her and to each of my aunties in vivid dreams. Bilhah dreamed of me one night while she lay in Jacob's arms. I saw you in a white gown of fine linen, covered with a long vest of blue and green beads. Your hair was braided, and you carried a fine basket through a pasture greener than any I have ever seen. You walked among queens, but you were alone. Rachel dreamed of my birth. You appeared at your mother's womb with your eyes open and your mouth full of perfect little teeth. You spoke as you slithered out from between her legs, saying, 'Hello, mothers. I am here at last. Is there nothing to eat?' That made us laugh. There were hundreds of women attending your birth, some of them dressed in outlandish clothing, shocking colors, shorn heads. We all laughed and laughed. I woke in the middle of the night laughing. My mother, Leah, said she dreamed of me every night. You and I whispered to each other like old friends. You were very wise, telling me what to eat to calm my upset stomach, how to settle a quarrel between Reuben and Simon. I told you all about Jacob, your father, and about your aunties. You told me about the other side of the universe, where darkness and light are not separated. You were such good company. I hated to wake up. One thing bothered me about those dreams, said my mother. I could never see your face. You were always behind me, just beyond my left shoulder, and every time I turned to catch a glimpse of you, you disappeared. Zilpah's dream was not filled with laughter or companionship. She said she saw me weeping a river of blood that gave rise to flat green monsters that opened mouths filled with rows of sharp teeth. Even so, you were unafraid, said Zilpah. You walked upon their backs and tamed their ugliness and disappeared into the sun. I was born during a full moon in a springtime, remembered for a plentitude of lambs. Zilpah stood on my mother's left side, while Bilhah supported her on the right. Inna was there to be on hand for the celebration and to catch the afterbirth in her ancient bucket. But Leah had asked Rachel to be midwife and catch me. It was an easy birth. After all the boys before me, I came quickly and as painlessly as birth can be. I was big as Judah, who had been the biggest. Inna pronounced me Leah's daughter in a voice full of satisfaction. As with all of her babies, my mother looked into my eyes first and smiled to see that they were both brown, like Jacob's and those of all her sons. After Rachel wiped me clean, she handed me to Zilpah, who embraced me, and then to Bilhah, who kissed me as well. I took my mother's breast with an eager mouth, and all the women of the camp clapped their hands for my mother and for me. Bilhah fed my mother honeyed milk and cake. She washed Leah's hair with perfumed water, and she massaged her feet. While Leah slept, Rachel, Zilpah, and Bilhah took me out into the moonlight and put henna on my feet and hands, as though I were a bride. They spoke 100 blessings around me, north, south, east, and west, to protect me against Lamashtu and the other baby-stealing demons. They gave me 1,000 kisses. In the morning, my mother began to count out 2 moon cycles in the red tent. After the birth of a boy, mothers rested from one moon to the next. But the birth of a birth giver required a longer period of separation from the world of men. The second month was such a delight, my mother told me. My sisters treated us both like queens. You were never left lying upon a blanket for a moment. There were always arms to hold you, cuddle you, embrace you. We oiled your skin morning and night. We sang songs into your ears, but we did not coo or babble. We spoke to you with all our words, as though you were a grown sister and not a baby girl. And before you were a year old, you answered us without a trace of a baby's lisp. As I was passed from my mother to one aunt after another, they debated my name. This conversation never ceased, and each woman argued for a favorite she had long hoped to give a daughter of her own womb. Bilhah offered Adani, in memory of my grandmother Ada, who had loved them all. This led to a long session of sighing and remembering Ada, who would have been so delighted by all of her grandchildren. But Zilpah worried that such a name would confuse the demons, who might think Ada had escaped from the underworld and come after me. Zilpah liked the name Isharay, which gave homage to the goddess and was easy to rhyme. She had plans for many songs in my honor, but Bilhah didn't like the sound of it. It sounds like a sneeze, she said. Rachel suggested Bentresh, a Hittite name she had heard from a trader's wife. It sounds like music, she said. Leah listened to them all, and when her sisters got too heated in their arguments about her daughter, threatened to call me Lilu, a name they all hated. In the second full moon after my birth, Leah rejoined her husband and told Jacob my name. She told me that I picked it myself. During my 60 days, I whispered every name my sister suggested into your little ear, every name I had ever heard, and even some I invented myself. But when I said Dina, you let the nipple fall from your mouth and looked up at me. So you are Dina, my lastborn, my daughter, my memory. Joseph was conceived in the days following my birth. Rachel had gone to Jacob with the news that he had finally sired a healthy girl. Her eyes shone as she told him, and Jacob smiled to see how his barren wife took pleasure in Leah's baby. That night, after they had enjoyed each other in the gentle fashion of familiar couples, Rachel dreamed of her first son and woke up smiling. She told no one when her moon blood failed to come. The many false starts and early losses haunted her, and she guarded her secret closely. She went to the red tent at the new moon and changed the straw as though she had soiled it. She was so slender that the slight thickening of her waist went unnoticed by everyone but Bilhah, who kept her own counsel. At the fourth month, Rachel went to Inna, who told her that the signs looked good for this boy, and Rachel began to hope. She showed her swelling belly to her sisters, who danced in a circle around her. She put Jacob's hand on the hillock of her womb. The father of 10 sons wept. Rachel grew sway-backed. Her little breasts grew full and painful. Her perfect ankles swelled. But she found nothing but delight in the complaints of breeding women. She began to sing as she tended the cooking fires and took up her spindle. Her family was surprised at the sweetness of her voice, which they had never heard raised in song. Jacob slept with Rachel every night of her pregnancy, a shocking breach of manners and an incitement to demons. But he would not listen to warning, and Rachel basked in his attentions as she grew large. In her 8th month, Rachel began to sicken. Her skin paled and her hair fell out. She could barely stand without falling into a faint. Fear swallowed her hope, and she called for Inna, who prescribed strong broths made from the bones of rams and bulls. She told Rachel to rest and came to visit her friend as often as she could. Inna came to deliver Rachel. The baby's feet were down, and there was bleeding long before he appeared. Inna's efforts to turn the child caused Rachel terrible pain, and she cried out so pitifully that all the children of the camp burst into tears at the sound. Jacob sat on the bama, staring at the face of the goddess, wondering whether he ought to make some offering to her, even though he had promised to worship his father's god only. He tore at the grass and held his head until he could stand the sounds of her screams no longer, and he went off to the high pasture until Rachel was delivered. It was 2 days before Reuben was sent to bring him back. 2 terrible days in which Leah and Zilpah and Bilhah each bade Rachel goodbye. It seemed so certain that she would die. But Inna did not give up. She gave Rachel every herb and every medicine in her pouches. She tried combinations that no herb weaver had used. She muttered secret prayers, though she was not initiated into the mysteries of magic words and incantations. Rachel did not give up, but fought for a heart's desire denied for 15 years. She battled like an animal, her eyes rolling, sweat pouring from her. Even after 3 days and 3 nights, she did not call for death to release her from the torment. "She was mighty to behold," said Zilpah. Finally, Inna got the baby to turn, but the effort seemed to break something within Rachel, whose body was seized by a shudder that would not let go. Her eyes rolled up into her head, and her neck tightened so that she faced backward. It was as though demons had taken possession of her body. Even Inna gasped. Then it was over. Rachel's body was released from death's grasp. The baby's head appeared, and Rachel found the last of her strength to push him out. He was small, with a big thatch of hair, a baby like all babies, wrinkled, homely, and perfect. Best of all, he was Rachel's. The tent fell silent as every woman wept grateful tears. Without a word, Inna cut the cord, and Bilhah caught the afterbirth. Leah cleaned Rachel, and Zilpah washed the baby. They sighed and wiped their eyes. Rachel would live to see her baby grow. Rachel recovered slowly, but she could not give suck. 3 days after Joseph's birth, her breasts grew hard and hot. Warm compresses eased her pain, but the milk dried up. Leah, who was nursing me at the time, took Joseph to her breast as well. Rachel's old anger at Leah flared at that, but it vanished when she discovered that Joseph was a fretful baby who screamed and squirmed until he lay in his own mother's arms. Part 2. My Story. Chapter 1. I am not certain whether my earliest memories are truly mine, because when I bring them to mind, I feel my mother's breath on every word. But I do remember the taste of the water from our well, bright and cold against my milk teeth, and I'm sure that I was caught up by strong arms every time I stumbled, for I do not recall a time in my early life when I was alone or afraid. Like every beloved child, I knew that I was the most important person in my mother's world, and most important not only to my mother, Leah, but to my mother aunties as well. Although they adored their sons, I was the one they dressed up and dandled when the boys were wrestling in the dirt. I was the one who continued going to the red tent with them long after I was weaned. As a baby, Joseph was my constant companion, first my milk brother, and later my truest friend. At 8 months, he stood up and walked over to me in my favorite spot at the front of my mother's tent. Though many months older, I was still unsteady on my feet, probably because my aunties liked to carry me. Joseph held out both his hands to me, and I stood up. My mother said that in return for showing me how to walk, I taught him to speak. Joseph liked to tell people that his first word was Dina, though Rachel assured me it was the word for Mama, Ima. No one thought Rachel would bear another child after the awful time she had had with Joseph, so he and I received the treatment given to the final fruit of a chief wife. According to the custom of the old days, the youngest child inherited a mother's blessing, and one way or another, fathers usually followed suit. But Joseph and I were petted and spoiled, also because we were the babies, our mother's lastborn, and our father's joy. We were also our older brother's victims. Age made two separate tribes among the children of Jacob. Reuben, Simon, Levi, and Judah were nearly men by the time I knew their names. They were off and gone, tending to the herds with our father. And as a group, they had little use for us small ones. Reuben was by nature kind to children, but we avoided Simon and Levi, who laughed at us and teased Tali and Issa, the twins. "How do you know which of you is which?" Levi taunted. Simon was even worse. "If one of you dies, our mother won't mourn, since she'll have one exactly the same." That always made Tali cry. I thought I saw longing in the way Judah watched our games. He was far too old to play with us, but as the youngest of the older brothers, he was the least among them and suffered for it. Judah often carried me on his back and called me a Hati, little sister. I thought of him as my champion among the big boys. At first, Zebulun was the leader of us younger ones, and he might have been a bully had we not adored him and obeyed him willingly. Dan was his lieutenant, loyal and sweet, as you'd expect of Bilhah's child. Gad and Asher were wild, headstrong, and difficult playmates, but they were such wonderful mimics, mocking Laban's lumbering walk and drink-slurred speech with such wicked accuracy, we forgave them anything in exchange for a performance. Naphtali, who was never called anything but Tali, and Issachar, or Issa, tried to lord it over me and Joseph because they were nearly 2 years older. They would call us babies, but a minute later they would join us on the ground, tossing a pebble into the air to see how many other stones we could pick up with the same hand. It was our favorite game, until I could pick up 10 stones to their 5. Then my brothers declared it a game fit only for girls and never played again. By our 6th year, Joseph and I had taken charge of the younger band because we were the best at making up stories. Our brothers carried us from the well to my mother's tent and bowed low before me, their queen. They would pretend to die when Joseph, their king, pointed a finger at them. We sent them out to do battle with demons and to bring us great riches. They crowned our heads with garlands of weeds and kissed our hands. I remember the day that game ended. Tali and Issa were doing my bidding, piling up little stones as an altar in my honor. Dan and Zebulun were fanning us with leaves. Gad and Asher were dancing before us. Then our older brothers happened by. Reuben and Judah smiled and walked on, but Simon and Levi stopped and laughed. "Look at how the babes lead the bigger boys by the nose. Wait until we tell our father that Zebulun and Dan are donkeys for the bear behinds. He'll make them wait another 2 years before letting them come up to the high pasture with us." They did not stop mocking until Joseph and I were alone, abandoned by our playmates, who suddenly saw themselves with their brothers' cold eyes. After that, Zebulun and Dan refused to do any more spinning for our mothers, and after much begging, they were permitted to follow their older brothers into the hills. The two sets of twins, when they weren't pulling weeds from the garden or helping at the loom, played by themselves, and the four of them became a tribe of their own, dedicated to hunting games and wrestling matches. Joseph and I turned more and more to each other. But it wasn't as much fun with just the two of us. Neither of us bent a knee to the other for the sake of a story, and Joseph had to contend with the taunts of our brothers, who abused him for playing with me at all. There were very few girls in our camp. The women joked that Jacob had poisoned the well against them. I tried to make friends with the few daughters of bondswomen, but I was either too old or too young for their games. And so by the time I could carry a water jug from the well, I started to think of myself as a member of my mother's circle. Not that children were often left to their games. As soon as we were old enough to carry a few sticks of wood, we were put to work pulling weeds and insects from the garden, carrying water, carding wool, and spinning. I do not remember a time before my hand held a spindle. I remember being scolded for my clumsiness, for getting burrs in my wool, and for the unevenness of my string. Leah was the best mother, but she was not the best teacher. Skills came to her so easily that she could not understand how even a small child could fail to grasp something so simple as the turning of string. She lost patience with me often. "How is it that a daughter of Leah could have such unlucky fingers?" she said one day, looking at the tangle I had made of my work. I hated her for those words. For the first time in my life, I hated my mother. My face grew hot as tears came to my eyes, and I threw a whole day spinning into the dirt. It was a terrible act of waste and disrespect, and I think neither of us could believe that I had done it. In an instant, the sharp slap of her palm against my cheek cracked the air. I was far more shocked than hurt. Although my mother cuffed my brothers from time to time, it was the first time she had ever struck me. I stood there for a long moment, watching her face twist in pain over what she had done. Without a word, I turned and ran to find Bila's lap, where I wept and moaned about the terrible wrong that had been done to me. I told my aunt everything that lay heavy upon my heart. I wept over my useless fingers, which would never get the wool to twist evenly, or the spindle to drop and turn smoothly. I was afraid that I had shamed my mother by being so awkward. and I was ashamed of the hatred I suddenly felt toward the one I loved so completely. Bilha stroked my hair until I stopped crying and fed me a piece of bread dipped in sweet wine. "Now I will show you the secret of the spindle," she said, putting a finger to my lips. "This is something your grandmother taught me, and now it is my turn to show you." Bilha put me on her lap, for which I was nearly too large. Her arms were barely long enough to reach around me, but there I sat, a baby once again, embraced in safety, while Bilha whispered the story of Uttu into my ear. Once, before women knew how to turn wool into string and string into cloth, people roamed the earth naked. They burned by day and shivered by night, and their babies perished. But Uttu heard the weeping mothers and took pity on them. Uttu was the daughter of Nanna, god of the moon, and of Ninhursag, the mother of the plains. Uttu asked her father if she might teach the women how to spin and weave so their babies would live. Nanna scoffed and said that women were too stupid to remember the order of cutting, washing, and combing of wool, the building of looms, the setting of woof and warp, and their fingers were too thick to master the art of spinning. But because Nanna loved his daughter, he let her go. Uttu went first to the east, to the land of the Green River, but the women there would not put aside their drums and flutes to listen to the goddess. Uttu went to the south, but she arrived in the middle of a terrible drought, when the sun had robbed the women of their memories. "We need nothing but rain," they said, forgetting the months when their children had died of cold. "Give us rain, or go away." Uttu traveled north, where the fur-clad women were so fierce they tore off a breast to ready themselves for the endless hunt. Those women were too hot-headed for the slow arts of string and loom. Uttu went to the east, where the sun rises, but found the men had stolen the women's tongues, and they could not answer for themselves. Since Uttu did not know how to speak to men, she came to Ur, which is the womb of the world, where she met the woman called Enhenduanna, who wished to learn. Uttu took Enhenduanna on her lap and wrapped her great arms around Enhenduanna's small arms, and laid her golden hands around Enhenduanna's clay hands, and guided her left hand and guided her right hand. Uttu dropped a spindle made of lapis lazuli, which turned like a great blue ball floating in the golden sky, and spun string made of sunlight. Enhenduanna fell asleep in Uttu's lap. As Enhenduanna slept, she spun without seeing or knowing, without effort or fatigue. She spun until there was enough string to fill the entire storehouse of the great god Nanna. He was so pleased that he permitted Uttu to teach Enhenduanna's daughters how to make pottery and bronze, music and wine. After that, the people could stop eating grass and drinking water, and ate bread and drank beer instead. And their babies, swaddled in wool blankets, no longer died of the cold, but grew up to offer up sacrifice to the gods. While Bilha told me the story of Uttu, she put her nimble hands around my clumsy ones. I smelled the soft, loamy musk that clung to my youngest auntie, and listened to her sweet liquid voice, and forgot all about the ache in my heart. And when her story was over, she showed me that the string on my spindle was as evenly made and strong as Leia's own handiwork. I kissed Bilha 100 kisses and ran to show my mother what I had done. She embraced me as though I had returned from the dead. There was no more slapping after that. I even came to enjoy the task of twisting clouds of unruly wool into the fine, strong threads that became my family's clothing and blankets and trade goods. I learned to love the way that my mind wandered where it would, while my hands followed their own course. Even when I was old, and my spinning was of linen rather than wool, I recalled my auntie's perfume and the way she pronounced the name of the goddess, Uttu. I told Joseph the story of Uttu the weaver. I told him the tale of the great goddess Inanna's journey to the land of the dead, and of her marriage to the shepherd king, Dumuzi, whose love ensured an abundance of dates and wine and rain. These were stories I heard in the red tent, told and retold by my mothers, and the occasional trader's wife who called the gods and goddesses by unfamiliar names and sometimes supplied different endings to ancient tales. Joseph, in turn, told me the story of Isaac's binding and the miracle of his release, and of our great-grandfather Abram's meetings with messengers from the gods. He told me that our father, Jacob, spoke with the El of his fathers, morning and evening, even when he made no sacrifice. Our father said that the formless, faceless God, with no other name than God, came to him by night in his dreams, and by day in solitude only, and that Jacob was sure that the future of his sons would be blessed by this one. Joseph described to me the wondrous grove of terebinth trees in Mamre, where our great-grandmother spoke to her gods every evening, and where someday our father would take us to pour a libation in the name of Sarai. Those were the stories Joseph heard from Jacob, sitting among our brothers while the sheep and goats grazed. I thought the women's stories were prettier, but Joseph preferred our father's tales. Our talk was not usually so lofty. We shared the secret of sex and begetting, and laughed aghast to think of our parents behaving like the dogs in the dust. We gossiped endlessly about our brothers, keeping close watch on the rivalry between Simon and Levi, which could flare into blows over something as trivial as the placement of a staff against a tree. There was an ongoing contest, too, between Judah and Zebulun, the two oxen among the brothers. But theirs was a good-natured battle to see which was the stronger, and each would applaud his brother's ability to lift great rocks and carry full-grown ewes across a meadow. Joseph and I watched as Zilpah's sons became my mother's champions, for Gad and Asher were embarrassed by their own mother's eccentricities. Her inability to make decent bread sent them to Leah's tent. They did not understand or value Zilpah's skill at the loom, and of course they had no way of knowing her talent for storytelling. So they carried their little trophies, flowers, brightly colored stones, the remains of a bird's nest, to my mother's lap. She would tousle their hair and feed them, and they would strut like little heroes. On the other hand, Tali and Issa, the twins of Leah's own womb, were not so fond of her. They hated looking so much alike and blamed their mother for it. They did everything they could to distinguish themselves from each other and were almost never seen together. Issa attached himself to Rachel, who seemed charmed by his attentions and let him carry and fetch for her. Tali became fast friends with Bilhah's Dan, and the two of them liked to sleep side by side in Bilhah's tent, hanging on the words of their big brother Reuben, who was also drawn to the peace and stillness that enveloped my aunt. Leah tried to bribe Issa and Tali back to her with sweets and extra bread, but she was far too busy with the work of her family to pine for attentions from two of her many sons, and she did not suffer for lack of love. When I caught her watching one of her boys walking toward another mother's tent at nightfall, I would pull at her hand. Then she would lift me up so that our eyes could meet, and kiss me on one cheek and then on the other, and then on the tip of my nose. And this always made me laugh, which would in turn always bring a warm smile to my mother's face. One of my great secrets was knowing I had the power to make her smile. My world was filled with mothers and brothers, work and games, new moons and good food. The hills in the distance held my life in a bowl filled with everything I could possibly want. I was a child when my father led us away from the land of the two rivers, south to the country of his birth. Young as I was, I knew why we were going. I could feel the hot wall of anger between my father and my grandfather. I could almost see the heat between them on the rare occasions they sat together. Laban resented my father for his accomplishments with the herds, and for his sons, who were so plentiful and so much more skillful than his own two boys. Laban hated the fact that he owed his success to the husband of his daughters. His mouth turned sour whenever Jacob's name was mentioned. As for my father, although he was the one who caused the flocks to multiply, the camp to fill with bondsmen, and the traders to make their way to our tents, he was never more than Laban's servant. His wages were meager, but he was thrifty and clever with his little store of goods, and he had been careful with the breeding of his own small flock of brindle goats and gray sheep. Jacob hated Laban's sloth, and the way he and his sons squandered his own good work. When the older boy, Kemuel, left his post guarding the rutting goats one spring, the best of them died from the battle between the strongest males. When Beor drank too much wine and slept, a hawk made off with a newborn kid Jacob had marked for sacrifice. The worst was when Laban lost Jacob's two best dogs, his smartest and his best loved. The old man had gone for a 3-day trading journey to Carchemish, and without asking, had taken the dogs to tend a herd so small a boy could have managed on his own. While Laban was in town, he sold them both for a pittance, which he then lost in a game of chance. The loss of his dogs put my father in a rage. The night Laban returned to camp, I heard their shouts and curses even as I fell asleep. Afterward, my father's scowl was impenetrable. His fists did not unclench until he had sought out Leah and poured out the details of this latest grievance. My mother and aunts had nothing but sympathy for Jacob. Their loyalty to Laban had never been strong, and as the years passed, they piled up reasons to despise him. Laziness, deceitfulness, the arrogance of his thick-headed sons, and his treatment of Ruti, which only worsened as the years passed. A few days after the fight about the dogs, Ruti came to my mother and threw herself on the ground. "I am lost," she cried, a sad puddle of a woman in the dust. Her hair was loose and covered with ashes, as though she had just buried her own mother. Laban had lost more than his coins in that Carchemish game. He had gambled away Ruti as well, and now a trader had arrived to claim her as his slave. Laban sat in his tent and refused to come out and acknowledge what he had done to the mother of his sons, but the trader had his walking staff as a bond and his overseer as a witness. Ruti put her forehead to the ground and begged Leah for help. Leah listened, and then turned to spit on her father's name. "The backside of a donkey has more merit than Laban," she said. "My father is a snake. He is the putrefied offal of a snake." She put down the jug of milk she was working into curd, and with heavy steps, marched to the near pasture where my father was still brooding about his dogs. My mother was so deep in her thoughts, she did not seem to notice that I followed her. Leah's cheeks turned red as she approached her husband. And then she did something extraordinary. Leah got down on her knees and, taking Jacob's hand, kissed his fingers. Watching my mother submit like this was like seeing a sheep hunting a jackal or a man nursing a baby. My mother, who never wanted for words, nearly stuttered as she spoke. "Husband, father of my children, beloved friend," she said, "I come to plead a case without merit, for pure pity's sake." "Husband," she said, "Jacob," she whispered, "you know I place my life in your keeping only, and that my father's name is an abomination to me. Even so, I come to ask that you redeem my father's woman from the slavery into which he has sold her. A man from Carchemish has come to claim Ruti, who Laban staked in his